Should he wake up at 6 a.m. for 10 years and then, in the blink of an eye, he might be killed, or at best, be unemployed, like our uncle.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, tension simmering in the occupied West Bank. Just hours ago, the Israeli military conducted deadly raids, that is, on two Palestinian refugee camps. Iran is demanding stronger guarantees for a sustainable deal to revive the JCPOA, as well as an end to the UN nuclear agency's politically motivated probes. Also in our headlines, in the UK, skyrocketing energy costs could drive NHS officials to adopt belt-tightening measures, with a likely impact on patient care. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story for this half hour, Israeli forces have killed two Palestinian men in the occupied West Bank amid rising tensions. One of the victims, Yazan Afana, was shot dead during Israel's storming of a neighborhood in the city of El Bira. The second victim, Samer Khalid, was killed by the Israeli fire during confrontations erupted during a regime's raid on the Balata refugee camp east of the city of Nablus. In recent months, the Israeli regime military has stepped up deadly raids in the occupied West Bank, launching fiercest assaults on the local population. The raids usually lead to clashes with Palestinians protesting the Israeli violations. A Palestinian prisoner on hunger strike for almost 6 months has decided to end his strike after Israeli officials agreed to release him. This came after Israel agreed to set a ceiling for Khalil Awada's administrative detention and release him on October the 2nd. Until then, he will remain at hospital to recover. Awada has been on an open-ended hunger strike for 172 days in protest at his detention without charge or trial. Doctors had already warned that he could die at any moment. The Palestinian inmate had been arrested 5 times since 2005 for political activism and was placed under the so-called administrative detention 3 times ever since. Over 680 Palestinians are being held by Israel without charge or trial. Thousands of Lebanese have attended a mass rally to commemorate the anniversary of what they consider the kidnapping of prominent Shia cleric Sayed Musa al-Sadr. The Lebanese parliament speaker and the head of the Amal movement spoke on the occasion, stressing that the case is a national issue.
On the 44th anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa al-Sadr, Lebanese parliament speaker Nabih Biri stressed that the kidnapping of the prominent Shia cleric was a crime that is a sovereign Lebanese case.
The failure of the current Libyan authorities to cooperate with the Lebanese authorities is considered to be collusion. The Arab League must press the authorities to cooperate.
Commenting on the issue of the demarcation of the country's southern maritime border with the Israeli occupying regime, the House Speaker accused the U.S. envoy of buying time.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks, but 1 month has passed and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is a very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men boarded a flight to Italy on August 31st. But al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayed Musa al-Sadr. But those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
Iran's president says the Islamic Republic of Iran has become so strong that hegemonic powers cannot coerce it into doing what they want.
Today, they know that they can no longer bully Iran. They know that the Islamic Republic of Iran has become powerful. They know that Iran is invincible.
Ebrahim Raisi said Iran has suffered numerous injustices over years and has now become so strong that the whole world is well aware of its high status around the globe. He said Iran has not only become a regional heavyweight but secured a good standing on the world stage. He said Iran has always been seeking justice for all. Elsewhere in his remarks, the president noted that Washington has admitted its maximum pressure policy against Tehran has failed. He then lambasted the global hegemony for violating human rights and keeping countries in ignorance. He made the comments at the 7th General Assembly of the Ahlal Bayt World Assembly in Tehran. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran seeks stronger guarantees from the U.S. to have a sustainable agreement to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA, or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks during a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. During the talks, the two sides discussed increasing bilateral cooperation regardless of the dictates of the West. Our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortunova, has a report for us.
Regular communications and meetings between Moscow and Iran officials are necessary to continue work along the lines outlined by both the Iranian and Russian presidents. This was also pointed out at the recent meeting between the foreign ministers of Iran and Russia in Moscow.
It is necessary to concentrate together with our friends, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the creation of reliable constructive mechanisms that allow, regardless of any diktat, to develop mutually beneficial cooperation.
Iranian foreign minister and his Russian counterpart held talks on Wednesday where they also discussed the issue of Ukraine. Amir Abdullahian said proposals were put forward regarding assisting with peace and the cessation of hostilities in Ukraine. However, the Iranian official did not provide other details on the matter. The head of the Iranian foreign ministry also announced Iran's readiness to help resolve the situation around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant.
It is necessary to use all existing opportunities to resolve this conflict. Therefore, Iran is ready to provide any assistance to establish calm and peace at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, as well as the surrounding area.
The two sides are targeting deepening trade ties in several fields, including satellites, grain, and a joint move away from the dollar. Nearly all joint projects are aimed at nullifying Washington's sanctions efforts, rendering them fruitless. Despite the sanctions, trade turnover between the two countries is growing at a record pace. Such an alliance between Iran and Russia is perceived especially sharply in the West.
Our countries interact historically. In the past, they were great empires. The USSR was under powerful pressure, as is Russia at the moment, as is Iran. Such states like Iran and Russia have their own independent national policy, and today's stage of cooperation between them looks very positive and in the required quality.
After the high-level meeting between the two diplomats, work on a comprehensive document of cooperation between Russia and Iran is at its final stage.
Both ministers pointed out that Russia and Iran are focused on creating such mechanisms that will allow the states to continue cooperation regardless of the actions of Western countries now, when the international situation requires regular synchronization of clocks and coordinations of their actions. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan is once again embroiled in controversy as he appears before Islamabad High Court over charges of contempt of the court. Kamran Youssef has the details.
Undeterred by legal and political challenges, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan arrives at Islamabad High Court. He was summoned over his derogatory remarks uttered during a speech in the capital, Islamabad, on August 20. Khan had threatened to file court cases against senior police officials after his close aide, Shehbaz Gill, was arrested on August 9. Khan accused police forces of torturing Gill while he was in custody. In the same speech, he also singled out a female judge, saying the judiciary is biased towards his party and that it should brace itself for the consequences. Khan has submitted a written reply to the court, saying he will not apologize for his remarks, but is ready to withdraw the words if they were inappropriate. Islamabad High Court has described Khan's response as unsatisfactory and directed him to submit a fresh statement. Khan can be disqualified for 5 years from taking part in politics if he is found guilty of contempt of court. His supporters believe Khan has done nothing wrong.
Imran Khan has not done nothing wrong, and he fully believes in independence of judiciary. He respects judiciary, whereas PMLN people, they attack judiciary every day. They should be held accountable.
Pakistan's law minister, however, is convinced that Khan indeed committed a contempt of court.
We believe that Imran Khan's case must be treated under Article 25 of the Constitution and in line with how courts in the past have dealt with the contempt cases against other politicians.
Khan was ousted from power in April through a vote of no confidence, but he termed his ouster as a US-backed conspiracy. His popularity, however, has increased in recent months. Many observers believe that any move to seek his disqualification may backfire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
UK hospitals have warned that patient care may have to be cut to offset huge increases in energy bills over the winter months. Most hospital groups say they expect bills to at least double as the price hikes have already kicked in. They say the gap in funding from rising inflation will either have to be made up by fewer staff being employed, longer waiting times for care, or other areas of patient care being cut back. They say failure to properly compensate the NHS for inflation will only increase pressure on the health service. UK inflation is at a 40-year high, with dire predictions that rates could climb even further. That makes households on non-domestic customers alike vulnerable to the surge in prices. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's legal team has slammed the U.S. government for its pursuit of classified documents at his home. Trump's lawyers dismissed as unjustified and legally dubious the FBI's raid on August the 8th in which the documents were seized. His attorney said the purported justification for the initiation of the government's probe was the alleged discovery of sensitive information in the presidential records. They said the discovery was to be fully anticipated given the very nature of presidential records. The reaction came in response to a bombshell filing in which the U.S. Department of Justice said top secret documents were likely concealed at Trump's estate to obstruct an FBI investigation. The government also rejected a call by Trump's legal team for an independent review of the material seized. The city of Jackson in the U.S. state of Mississippi is still going through a water crisis. Residents there are facing the third straight day without running water. Hundreds of vehicles waited in a line at a distribution site where volunteers handed out cases of bottled water. Others were searching for water at local stores where supplies were depleted or sold out. The crisis started over a poorly maintained treatment plant failed this week, causing taps to run dry. Many businesses are shut down in Jackson and the surrounding area, which is home to some 180,000 people. The water crisis has caused local schools to resume classes online. Jackson residents say they are left in difficult circumstances and that the government is not caring.
People are fed up. They're running to bordering cities who have clean water to just bathe and going to their grocery stores having to buy up all of the water because we have none. We need help. We need federal oversight. We need something to happen because for it to be going on for years and the governor not caring, the mayor hiring incompetent people to run the water treatment plants, it's like it's never ending.
The water treatment plant broke down from complications after a weekend of heavy rain and flooding. An emergency pump has brought the plant back to about 40% of its capacity. However, the distribution system is still short of sufficient water pressure to guarantee citywide service. Authorities say they expect water to be restored by the end of the week. President Joe Biden has declared an emergency for Mississippi, ordering federal assistance to supplement the state's response to the ongoing crisis. The U.S. has invaded several countries over the past decades. A major new study has concluded that U.S. military interventions increasingly target the Middle East and Africa, making up more than a quarter of such campaigns throughout its history. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria are some of the recent examples where American interventions caused chaos, bloodshed, and instability.
The death toll from the latest clashes between rival armed groups in the Libyan capital Tripoli passed 30, with over 150 people also injured. The fighting raised fears of a major nationwide conflict between a UN-recognized and parliament-backed government. Libya's unraveling has become a symbol of the limits of U.S. power and the folly of military intervention in distant countries. The U.S. is to blame for Libya's current turmoil. After an American-led intervention in 2011 to stop Muammar Gaddafi's atrocities, created a security vacuum in the country. Since then, the security vacuum has been filled by legions of armed militias, foreign mercenaries, extremists, human traffickers, and regional and international powers who have all transformed the North African country into an exporter of instability and mayhem. The footprints of Washington's intervention in war are in several other countries as well. U.S. interventions in past decades have failed to bring democracy to countries around the world. Countries like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan have been some of the victims of U.S. interventions, still experiencing chaos. A major new study has concluded that U.S. military interventions increasingly target the Middle East and Africa, making up more than a quarter of the country's campaigns throughout its history. The United States is spending an exorbitant amount of money on arms while making trouble in the world with its hundreds of foreign military bases. The U.S. military had about 750 bases overseas across 80 countries and territories in 2021. Earlier this year, the Biden administration expanded the U.S. military footprint in Africa by reversing a decision by former U.S. President Donald Trump to pull troops out of Somalia, thereby establishing a permanent military base in the country.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Limelight. Justin Greening, who was Education Secretary under the former British Prime Minister Theresa May, says education in England has been badly disrupted by COVID and now school budgets are being drastically eaten away by inflation, meaning there's less to invest in young people's futures. We present you an article written by Sally Wheel. The piece is titled Leading Tories Call on New UK Prime Minister to Tackle Crisis Facing Schools Over Soaring Costs. Leading UK Conservatives, including two former Tory education secretaries, have urged the incoming Prime Minister to address rising cost pressures on schools as a matter of urgency, as head teachers struggle to pay soaring energy and wage bills. With the start of the new academic year just a few days away, many schools in England are already overwhelmed by energy price rises in excess of 200%. With worse to come, plus the additional cost of unfunded pay rises and mounting inflation. Without additional funding, school leaders are warning of redundancies, bigger class sizes and cuts to the curriculum, which they say could damage children's education for years to come. Schools are not covered by the cap on household energy bills. Kenneth Baker, who was Education Secretary from 1986 to 1989, said schools would go into the red without government intervention. Baker said, "We're heading into a really ghastly two-year period, and it's going to require remarkable leadership to come out of this," smiling. Justin Greening, who was Education Secretary under Theresa May, said, "Children and schools were facing an education double hit after the coronavirus pandemic." Greening, who founded the Social Mobility Pledge, a scheme aimed at broadening social mobility and opportunities, said, "Education has been badly disrupted by COVID, and now school budgets are being drastically eaten away by inflation, meaning there's less to invest in young people's futures." Justin Greening added, "Education has to be at the heart of the new government's levelling up strategy, whoever is running it, so the pressures on school budgets can't be ignored." There has been criticism of the two Tory leadership contenders, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, who have both spoken in favour of grammar schools, but have said less about the issues facing schools now. Kenneth Baker added, "All the attention has been on the health service. The education service has not really featured for the leadership candidates. They've just touched on it." Baker said, "I think the new education secretary will have to go back and ask for more money, which they probably won't get, so there's going to be a huge pressure on schools. Some schools are bound to go into the red. It's going to be a very critical year, and a huge amount of trouble is going to be caused in the UK's education system." Kenneth Baker added, "If they overspend, a big deficit will build up. And how are they ever going to meet that deficit? They can't. They're in a cycle of actual financial decline. I think it will be a very difficult time for schools. Teachers are going to try very hard to maintain as high a level of education as they can do. But I think some schools will have to go to 4 days, some may go to 3 days." He noted, "That creates problems for families. What do they do if the parents are both working? We're heading into a really ghastly two-year period, and it's going to require remarkable leadership to come out of this," smiling. The last time schools attempted to save money by trimming the school week was in 2017. Many school leaders have disputed claims that such action is on the cards again, and the government has already stressed it expects schools to remain open morning and afternoon, 5 days a week. Robert Halfond, the Tory chair of the House of Commons Education Committee, said extra funding for energy bills or energy caps for schools would be little more than sticking plaster, and instead called on the next government to tackle poverty by introducing a radical programme for change that had the scale and vision of Lyndon Johnson's expansion of US welfare legislation in the 1960s. Robert Halfond added, whoever becomes the new government, they need to listen to Mr. Johnson, and I don't mean Boris Johnson, I mean President Lyndon B. Johnson. In 1965, he introduced a landmark war on poverty. Halfond said, we've had big debates during the leadership contest about the National Health Service and the economy and the cost of living. Yet education seems to have fallen by the wayside. When Lyndon B. Johnson got in, it was the cornerstone of his war on poverty. We need the equivalent of that here. A Department for Education spokesperson said the government recognised schools, much like the wider economy, were facing increased costs. The spokesperson said, cost increases should be seen in the wider context of funding for schools, with budgets to rise by £7 billion by 2024-2025, compared with 2021-2022, including £4 billion in this financial year alone. This is a 7% cash terms, a pupil increase, compared with 2021-2022, and will help schools to meet wider cost pressures, including energy prices and staff salaries. Robert Halfond, who is supporting Rishi Sunak in the Tory leadership race, said the additional funding made available to schools was before the war in Ukraine and its impact on energy bills. Robert Halfond said, Liz Truss has talked about increasing defence and health spending, but what about education? It is the major challenge of our times, in my view. Estelle Morris, a former Labour Education Secretary, echoed his concerns. She said, in Birmingham, where I chair the Education Partnership, it's a huge issue. My frustration is the lack of honesty on the part of the government. When the head teachers say the costs are so enormous it's causing them a problem, the only response you get is, we've increased the school budget by X. She added, schools are about to go back, and as far as I can hear and see, there's not a sensible conversation going on. Nothing is going to happen unless we've got ministers who say, I can see this is a problem. Any money they announced as extra, it was never ever ever to do with the increased cost of energy. Estelle Morris also expressed concern about the state of school buildings. She said, we can't have cold schools. It's against the law. I remember when I was a teacher, if the temperature dropped and we couldn't keep schools warm, if the boiler broke down, for example, we had to send the kids home. She added, we can't be the sort of nation that claims to be trying to steady the ship after all these children have suffered under the pandemic, then say we're closing schools because we can't pay the electricity or the gas bill. We can't be that kind of a country. On school opening hours, the Department for Education spokesperson said, regular school attendance is vital for children's education, development and well-being, and we expect all schools to be open morning and afternoon, 5 days a week. Jeff Barton, the General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, said, we're extremely concerned that the new term will see schools and colleges in the midst of a full-blown funding crisis, and that they will have to make impossible choices about where to make cuts. Jeff Barton added, the problem is that they're facing huge increases in energy bills as well as pay awards for which there is no additional government funding. The last thing they want to do is cut educational provision, but with massive extra costs and not enough money to pay for them, there is only one way this is going to go.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
سید محمد حسینی بهشتی On December 12, 1925, in a totally undemocratic move, Mr. Reza Pahlavi is appointed the king of Iran. During these days, when the world is taking a fresh breath of temporary peace after World War I, Reza Khan Mirpanch sets his sights on creating fundamental changes in Iran. Different tasks including the construction of a nationwide railway system, banning all Islamic veils, the establishment of Iran's first civil laws and other such activities, the founding of a modern education system is among the first orders of Iran's king, who wears a military uniform. Only a few months after the coronation of the new Shah of Iran, the government is tasked with the development and expansion of education at the elementary level. Old schools under the supervision of clerics are shut down and replaced with schools with teachers who are not clerics and follow the guidelines of Reza Shah's Ministry of Culture. With the establishment of a General Office of Writing, drafting educational books for elementary students begin. The Shah's goal from this action is to unify school books and have direct supervision on what students are being taught at schools across the country. This supervision can be defined in one thing: nationalism and love of the Shah must be included in all school books. In early 1951, when Reza Shah's reign has come to an end and Mohammad Reza Pahlavi replaces his father on the throne, the English teacher at the biggest school in Qom, which is known as the Second Dar ul Funun, is a young, well-dressed cleric who wears sunglasses, and people point him out in the streets and say that he can speak a foreign language. Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti was born in Isfahan. He was a seminary student at the Qom Seminary School and a university student at Tehran's college. He was talented and an elite student. He chose teaching to make a living. He is not financially well off, but he is very different with the rest of the seminary students. He doesn't charge anyone tuition, writes his daily schedule on a piece of paper, and hangs it up on the wall in his room. His appointments, when to chat with friends, he's even defined joking for himself. When he becomes a top student during his BA course, they propose that he either stay in Tehran and take on an official job or become a teacher in the education system. He he chooses teaching and Qom. Because of his command of the English language, the education system accepts him as a teacher at Qom's Hakim Nizami High School. In his memoirs, he writes, "The beginning of my political activities based on Islamic motivations is related to the year 1950, when Ahmad Qawam made his famous bullish speech, and I heard it on the radio. I left the house instinctively. It was a very interesting feeling for me. I didn't even know which direction I was going in, but I knew I shouldn't be at home." The nationalization of the oil movement and the link between Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti with struggles of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani are the beginning days of the young teacher's life, which was full of ups and downs. From then on, his presence in many of the political gatherings in Tehran becomes serious. On August 19, 1953, with the defeat of the nationalization of the oil industry through a coup d'etat, many had lost hope. But he would say, "No matter what condition they create, we'll come up with a new plan for it. Our problem is that we do not have enough organized members, and we have to, under the cover of a cultural movement, train them." The same idea, training members, was a spark that helped establish the religious and knowledge of high school in Qom. It was the first school which was established with efforts of the son of the founder of the Qom Seminary, Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, and the young Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti is put in charge of it. Now, with the establishment of the religion and knowledge school, Beheshti's extremely important and serious activities begin. Everything is done under his supervision. The school becomes one of the best schools in the country very soon. Beheshti's seriousness leads to the acceptance of all the students of the school in the entrance exam who had graduated in its first year. But his main goal in this school is training people who will play important roles in movements in the country. The entrance exam shouldn't be a preventive barrier when it comes to the students educated at this school. The mid-50s, and Sayyid Muhammad is almost 30 and successful and well-known. His organized lifestyle helps him juggle a number of activities well and simultaneously. He studies in Allama Tabatabai's classes for 5 years, and Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Muhaqqiq Damad, who is strict when it comes to calling someone a mujtahid, explicitly calls him one. He also passes the Islamic philosophy doctorate exam held by Tehran University. In 1956, with the establishment of the Intelligence and Security Organization of Iran, known as SAVAK, the heavy shadow of the government casts clouds over the entire country, an organization which becomes scarier and more ghastly by the day. During these years, Beheshti comes up with a new idea: teaching modern sciences to seminary students during the night shift at the religion and knowledge school. He believes that seminary students must be educated like literature diploma holders and in being familiar with English, Arabic, and natural studies. This idea attracts about 30 seminary students interested in learning to the religion and knowledge school in its first term. Now everyone calls Sayyid Muhammad Dr. Beheshti, a doctor who, in addition to all the work and attention that he has in school, is well-read about Islamic economy, the banking system, and issues related to Islamic governance. He even exchanges views and ideas with seminary students and university professors. He sets up a group made up of Mr. Musavi Ardabili, Mahdavi Kani, Meshkini, Hashimi Rafsanjani, Mesbah Yazdi, and others to produce a scientific and academic research regarding Islamic governance. In March 1961, unexpected news causes grief among the people. Ayatollah Brugerdi has passed away. The death of Ayatollah Brugerdi causes all the people to take to the streets. The huge presence of the people in Ayatollah Brugerdi's funeral shows off how respected the Shia clergy are among the nation. With the death of Ayatollah Brugerdi, the atmosphere of the struggle against the Shah's regime changes and the role of the Shia clergy and seminaries become more solidified. He was in Isfahan and busy visiting his relatives when he was shocked with the news of the vicious attack of the Shah's regime to Faizia school. But he cannot remain silent and sends Imam Khomeini a telegraph from the clerics of Isfahan and condemns this attack with a gentle tone. Savak doesn't even overlook this action. He is called in and forced to make a written commitment that he will not interfere in such matters again. On October 3, 1963, Savak documents show the following comments. After the incident in Qom and the arrest of Mr. Khomeini, teachers, instructors, and students in the city of Qom encounter new provocations against the government. And one of the provocateurs is Muhammad Beheshti, who has a bachelor's degree in religious studies and teaches at the above-mentioned city's religion and knowledge school. What's obvious is that students have been provoked against the government by the aforementioned individual. These provocations have been deemed effective and tangible. Savak has officially announced that naming Ayatollah Khomeini in speeches is a crime. But Beheshti ignores Savak's announcements and at the end of all of his speeches, prays for the well-being of Ayatollah Khomeini. Finally, in the fall of 1963, Savak's worrisome reports create problems for the doctor and cause his forced transfer from Qom to Tehran. But the action may not end up to be a bad thing for him, because now in Tehran, he has a larger arena to continue his activities. With the murder of Hassan Ali Mansour by the Mutalifiz military wing, more are worried about him. His friends were sure that his name was in Savak's blacklist because of the Mutalifiz, known as the Islamic Coalition Party. They don't want this man, with so much ability, to become embroiled in a court battle and prison. He receives messages from everywhere to leave Iran any way he can. But he believes he has to stay and finish his unfinished work and research, especially now that they've exiled Ayatollah Khomeini. On the morning of March 23, 1964, Dr. Beheshti left Tehran for Kazimiya. A week later, from Iraq to Jordan, and from then on, he goes to Palestine, Syria, and Beirut. But finally, on April the 11th, he leaves Beirut for Hamburg. In Germany, he uses all of his effort in the prosperity of the mosque and the establishment of the Muslim Students' Union in Europe. The mosque grows bigger, and on March 12, 1966, the union officially begins its work. In the spring of 1970, Beheshti is getting ready to travel to Iran. He intends to return to Germany, but thinks there's the possibility that Savak will not allow it. Even though he's tried to train mosque attendees and the university students' union to be independent, He still speaks quite frankly during the last session. Friends, when I'm gone and my trip takes long, don't ever gather around and say that when I was here, you were able to do some things. If the union is effective with the presence of a certain person, even if it's a person like me, it's best that the union does not exist at all. Your organization has to pave its way, be it with me or without me. Find replacements for forces you lose. You are the creations of the God of the world. You are human beings whose battleground is the world. Don't limit yourselves so much. The teacher comes back to Iran. During these days, the political and religious atmosphere in the country is embroiled by many problems. Just as he had guessed, he was banned from leaving the country. It had been a while that the Shah had been informed that religious school books need revisions. The tiring literature in these books, alongside the bland and difficult fiqh education, had turned this period into the most catastrophic period in schools. And the Shah orders the Minister of Education that the compilation of these books be revised. And the minister looks for people who can help with this revision. She reaches a doctor who many say is very educated and insightful. He has a vision and had spent time in Europe. And that man is none other than Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti. The good thing about this is that Mr. Bourghei, the person in charge of the revision at the Ministry of Education, knows the doctor and wants to put together a team made up of Beheshti Bahonar and Golzadeh Ghafouri. The doctor likes the work and the team and accepts. Dr. Beheshti is thinking about how to properly teach the main concepts of religion to the students. He even thinks about topics regarding politics and divine leadership. He has no doubt that his cooperation with the Shah's Ministry of Education will make him infamous, but he takes the risk and enters the arena. He says, "I preferred this job to teaching as a university professor as a duty and tradition. I told friends that we will take Islamic Jihad to schools through books and pamphlets and religious studies. The Islam that's about how to live and lifestyle, not the Islam that is part of life." Beheshti set a condition for his cooperation. "My name shouldn't be printed among the authors. My nature does not allow me to have my name in a book that has photos of the Shah and his family." On March 9, 1971, the teacher starts his new work. Beheshti prepares the entirety of the lesson, and Bahonar and Golzadeh are in charge of preparing the content. At times, they ask Mr. Mutahiri for help. The prepared content gets its final approval by the group, and in the end, they give samples of the book to nearly 1,000 people so they could read them and give them their opinions. From university professors to students. The doctor does the job perfectly and with high quality. He even becomes adamant that the photos in the book are in color. The doctor believes the students must definitely see the red flag of Imam Hussein. Slowly, the books reach the students, not only millions of secondary and high school students across the country, but also their teachers become familiar with a new view and outlook of Islam. Later on, authors of the group hold seminars for teachers in different cities. Beheshti himself teaches the entire book to the teachers once. During these sessions, he's sensitive to know how religion teachers react while reading the textbook, what their opinion and criticism of the textbook is, what he does causes the training of a large number of educated individuals of this influential class. Beheshi says, "We were always worried, not out of fear that they'd arrest us and put us in prison or things like that. We were never scared of these things. We were worried that the work we were doing would be left unfinished. With God's help and relying on a well-planned method, we were successful in preparing the last of the books. Exactly after we'd sent that last book for publication, the hellish organization of the Shah found out what we'd done." On April 1, 1974, Sobok writes in one of his documents, "Beheshi's employment and sensitive but secondary positions of the Ministry of Education is not favorable because of his past political activities." This happens exactly a few days after the female minister's appreciation of Mr. Beheshi for his total seriousness and interest in Iran's school books organization. But it's too late. The books have been published, and millions of students across the country have access to them. Sobok asks the Ministry of Education for explanations a number of times. But the revolutionary voices of protest can now be heard from every corner of the country. The years from 1970 to 1976 are six influential years of the presence of the teacher in the systemization of the minds of the students of Iran. Dr. Sayed Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, born in Isfahan, a student of Qom's seminary school and a graduate of University of Tehran, known back then as Maqul and Mangul College, a talented genius and a revolutionary fighter. A cleric who's a teacher who started his struggle against Taghut from small classrooms in a school in Qom, and with effort and hard work, made it to the highest positions of influence in the Ministry of Education. And in the end, he was able to train a generation whose freedom-seeking and fighting injustice spirit was heard by the entire world, the huge revolution in Iran.
In the limelight.
The U.S., the only country to have criminally indulged in the terrorist acts of using atomic weapons, as it did in this same month of August, 77 years ago, on two occasions, by targeting the unsuspecting cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to massacre hundreds of thousands of innocent men, women, and children, in addition to polluting water and agricultural resources, can never be trusted. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading FRCCAL NPT Review Forum. Stay tuned for more. The FRCCAL 4-week forum at the UN headquarters in New York, called the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty NPT Review Conference, was an exercise in futility because of the lack of seriousness of the world's dangerously nuclear-armed powers from dismantling their doomsday arsenals. If reports are to be believed, a total of 13,000 nuclear warheads are stockpiled in the U.S., France, Britain, China and Russia, in addition to a few hundred more possessed by India, Pakistan, and the illegal Zionist entity which refused to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT. Despite the efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Syria, and other countries, the forum totally ignored any mention of Israel, which is the main impediment to a nuclear-free West Asia. Such selective approach by the big powers who cry wolf at the mention of Iran, even though the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a fatwa against manufacture and use of weapons of mass destruction, is indicative of the hypocrisy prevailing at the NPT, as well as at the Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, which has politicized Tehran's peaceful nuclear project, in spite of the fact that its inspectors and round-the-clock cameras have time and again ruled out any deviation. Yet, in spite of its pretensions to check proliferation, the U.S. regime continues to test and manufacture even more deadly nuclear armaments, while the two West European regimes of France and Britain have not hidden their lust for these instruments of mass destruction, forcing Russia, China, and to a little extent North Korea, in developing means of deterrence to prevent being sitting ducks.